Film Spotting is brought to you by the new PeerFlix.com, a fun place to get movies for less. And by Favre Forever, now on DVD. Relive Brett Favre's finest moments and see how the NFL's only three-time MVP became one of the most beloved players in NFL history. Take the Lambeau Leap for Favre Forever, now on DVD and available at ProFootballDVD.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. On this week's show, Sam and I present a staggeringly lucid analysis of David Lynch's Inland Empire and share some thoughts on Tom Tykwer's Perfume, The Story of a Murderer.
Plus, Adam's interview with Tykwer, Massacre Theater, the long-delayed fifth film in our animation marathon, Spirited Away, music from The Silos, and the top five most deserving Oscars.
That's right. The few moments when Oscar actually got it right. But first, just when you thought you had Mulholland Drive all figured out, David Lynch returns with an even more confounding piece of cinema.
Yeah, here's what I can tell you for sure about the plot of the nearly three-hour Inland Empire. Laura Dern is Nikki Grace, a fairly well-established actress in Hollywood, think Laura Dern, who is waiting to hear if she's been cast in a new film. The end. As far as I can tell, everything else that happens in Inland Empire is likely a dream. Probably Dern's, maybe someone else's too, maybe several people's, including Lynch himself. The title of the film is perhaps the best and maybe only genuine clue that Lynch offers us, Inland Empire, which I took to be a poetic way to describe the unconscious mind or the dream world. Are we in agreement so far?
We are in agreement so far.
The scenes that make up Dern's dream, scenes that may or may not reflect a 40-something actress's anxiety about working in youth-obsessed Hollywood, about acting in general, about starting work on a new film, about death, about marriage, about rabbits, are only loosely connected to each other, and attempts to follow any single narrative thread is likely going to end in frustration. Are the scenes with a director played by Jeremy Irons real rehearsals for a film? Is Dern really having an affair with her co-star played by Justin Theroux? Is Julia Ormond Theroux's wife in real life or in the movie? And seriously, what's the deal with the guy speaking German in the surreal sitcom with the three rabbits? I've only seen the film once, which is going to be too much for some, not nearly enough for many others, and just right for a very select few. So I apologize for my juvenile analyzation of the film, but Lynch has been very upfront in declaring the film abstract art, and that's pretty much all you can do with this film. Watch it and then try and work it out, or just decide that it's a piece of pretentious nonsense and skip the whole thing, which is certainly your right. Adam, we saw this film at the Music Box on opening night in Chicago. Lynch was in attendance. He introduced the film. He answered some questions afterwards, and incredibly, not once during the Q&A did anyone ask Lynch what the hell we just all witnessed. Mm-hmm. They were too busy finding an original way to kiss his ass.
Exactly.
And, failing miserably. It was embarrassing.
It was.
I know the film left you as confounded as I was. What did you decide on your car ride home alone? Another brilliant mind cinecast by Lynch, or did Inland Empire test your patience?
Well, it tested my patience a little bit. I have to admit that, you know, because this is part of the David Lynch experience, of course, going to these films expecting to be disoriented, expecting to be confused, and that's part of the beauty of these David Lynch films. But here it did bother me a little bit because this movie's different from Lynch's previous films in at least two obvious ways. I think one, I'm pretty sure it's his longest movie. Mm-hmm. It's 3 hours long, pretty much right at 3 hours.
And it feels
it does. I also think it is his most disorienting, convoluted movie. I mean, this makes Mulholland Drive seem like the straight story by comparison. I actually had an easier time following Lost Highway than Inland Empire, and I never thought I'd say that about any film. That's how much Lost Highway confounded me. But, you know, I read an interview with Lynch in the Chicago Tribune that I thought was interesting where someone asked him what the film was about. The writer said, when people ask you, when acquaintances ask you what the film was about, what do you say? And you mentioned the Q&A we were at. I actually give our audience, that's the one thing I'll give him credit for, is that they didn't ask that stupid question. Because you know he's not going to answer.
Yeah, he's not interested in
telling, nor should he be, really.
Right.
And his first answer, he said, was always, I don't know. And then if he's pressed a little further, he says, it's about a woman in trouble. And, you know, regardless of how confused we all are at the end of the film, that's the one thing I think any viewer of the movie takes away from it. Laura Dern is in trouble as an actress in Hollywood, as a wife, whatever. And you told me your theory that you came up with with your wife on the way home, and I think it makes as much sense as any other theory I've heard, and you can expound on that a little bit. But it's this idea of this actress in Hollywood and kind of the trials and tribulations of being an actress like Laura Dern. Mm-hmm. I mean, on that level, I think that very much is something that's going on. But the question is, when you get to the end of the film, I think, is whether this three-hour ride through this psychological nightmare is worth the ride. Does it hold your attention? And more importantly, does it provoke a visceral reaction, which Lynch, as much as any filmmaker around, is hoping for? And I do say the answer is yes, absolutely. There are moments in the film I haven't been able to shake for 2 weeks since we saw it, and I probably never will.
I totally agree. Yeah, I went into this experience, and maybe that's the right way to describe it, sure that I wouldn't understand a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I went into Mulholland Drive a little unprepared, and maybe, you know, that sort of resulted in me being completely confounded by it, lost by it, and then maybe caught up in the whole visceral feeling that Lynch can share with an audience. In this case, I was like, I know I'm not going to understand out of the gate. Fine. I'm totally fine with that. But the fact is, he kind of lulled me into thinking I was going to be able to follow it. I mean, there's a kind of coda at the beginning that doesn't make any sense. There are the German people. We see some rabbits. Julia Armand crying, looking
Polish
at the television.
People,
I'm sorry, Polish. You're right. I don't want to lump the Eastern Europeans.
In the Baltics.
On cloth. Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, but once the Dern character is introduced, and it's Dern as you imagine she might be, or at least a kind of persona that we'd be comfortable with. She's an actress in Hollywood. She lives in a very nice home. She gets an odd
visitor,
a neighbor. How far this visitor has come, and calling herself a neighbor is up to the imagination, maybe, which is surreal in a Lynchian kind of way. And even then, she goes maybe the next day and she's been cast in a film and we see her in rehearsals and it all makes really a lot of sense and it's engaging. And then at some point you realize you haven't understood anything that's gone on for a half hour or more, and you start to shift in your seat. But that being said, as frustrated as I was, as bored as I was occasionally, it's been 2 weeks, like you said, I really can't wait to see this movie again. I really want to see it again. And part of when I look back on like what was it that I really enjoyed about the experience or that I took from it, and it really is looking at those moments, and we saw it with this packed audience, probably 500 or 600 people at the Music Box. Lynch, in every moment, as little as this world that he's created is connected with our world, as few of the rules of our world exist in his world, he still had complete control over my reaction as an audience member. When he wanted me to laugh, I was laughing. Mm-hmm. When he wanted me to be scared or unnerved, I was.
Yeah.
And the actors knew exactly what was going on in every scene. Lynch knows, I think, what's going on in every scene. Even if maybe he is being completely honest when he says, I don't know what this film is about. I couldn't tell you what the narrative is. He still knows in every moment what works.
Yeah.
And so I have to say, I liked it.
Right.
I can recommend it. Mm-hmm. But that being said, you know,
it's a trip.
It's a trip.
It is a trip. But in case you go to it thinking and you walk out that it really is just this bunch of stuff thrown together. It's this Lynch unconscious rambling dream, and it could only make sense to the person having the dream and no one else can. That may be true, actually, that part of it. But you know it's not true, I think, because of the fact that the connections the film makes from scene to scene and throughout the movie. I didn't write down specific things that jumped out at me, but I know there were several moments where I noticed certain motifs, whether it was lighting, whether it was lines of dialogue, whether it was characters reappearing and disappearing or whatever, certain character movements. They all appeared throughout the film, linking certain things together, not unlike another kind of confounding film, The Fountain. So there is a connective tissue that holds it all together, that does keep it from just spiraling completely out of control, that does make you feel like, that does lull you, as you said, into some sense that you have an idea what's going on, even though there's really no way you could. So, you know,
and maybe you shouldn't in some way.
No.
You shouldn't be following a narrative. You really do have to let the film give you some sense of an impression. That being said, it's hard to rid yourself of this desire to follow a narrative through, and that can be frustrating.
Oh, sure.
But
yeah. Well, you know, the digital video here, too, is the big thing that he shot with this Sony PD-150 camera, which is not only just a regular camera. I mean, it's not HD or anything, as far as I know.
Right.
This
is
just a regular kind of prosumer, consumer model. You know, you can go out and buy at Best Buy and shoot with this camera. And that's exactly what he did. And, you know, it really does pay off here because sometimes it looks beautiful. There are certain shots, actually, that I think look just as good as film for whatever reason. And I was sitting there going, wait, that's digital? It looked like film. other times, it just exposes the horror we're seeing on screen even more, the grotesque nature of some of the faces we're seeing, and, you know, the washed-out quality of the lighting. It brings this harshness to everything, you know, especially these wide-angle close-ups that just really does increase this horror factor. And really, when it gets down to it, this film, I think, is a nightmare, and I think the digital video really works there. And, you know, a lot of people are praising Laura Dern for her performance here. I guess I was pretty entranced by it as well.
I was too, yeah. I mean, I am sort of haunted by it in a way, and I don't want to overuse a phrase that's hard to articulate, but I do keep thinking of those scenes. I think of her character, I think of her face, and it recalls that sense of anxiety that I felt. And I have to give credit to that, and I'm not an art critic, but the composition of the shots too. I think the one image that lingers is an unexplained shot of an arm. Really, it's all we see, the camera following Dern, I think, and an arm. And the way it moves out of the frame is just really beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and it's several scenes like that, several moments in the film like that, that, you know, there are some scenes that provide a sort of conventional sense of anxiety. Okay, we're going down a dark staircase. We don't know what's at the bottom. And that's in some cases where I felt like Lynch might have been cheating in that it's conventional in its using conventional kind of cinematic images in some way to create anxiety where other things are so unusual. And I don't know whether to blame him for that because it's so disorienting in that sense. It is working on some level.
Yeah, you know, we've gotten some great emails. We've received a number of great emails from listeners so far about this film. And one of them, I just want to read part of it real quick from a listener, David Wester in Portland, Oregon, who I think summed up really well for me the experience of seeing it. And he said that his previous experience with Lynch's trippier films, like Lost Highway, left him with the impression that his subconscious mind had just been told a story his conscious mind couldn't understand. Empire left him with the impression that his subconscious mind was told a story that was a bit too long, too digressive, and a bit empty, an experience I can only liken to trying to eat soup with a slotted spoon. I know, Sam, you love food metaphors,
metaphors are my favorite.
Your criticism. But I think, you know, when he sums up here, he says, still, I did like the film, and it grows on me with each passing day. It's nice that Lynch is still out there tearing apart filmic conventions for the rest of us sinners. I think that's where I come down on. I think it sounds like you do, too, as well.
I do.
You do, by the end of it, you can't help but get a little bit bored, I think.
Yeah.
I was there anyway. But it does haunt you, and it stays with you, and the more you try to piece it together, the more interesting it becomes.
Yeah, and I think the trap is the pretentious trap. It's just like, you're kind of pretentious for recommending a film like this in that it is an art exercise.
Sure.
You know, at the same time, I feel like the people that say this is the best film of the year, and there have been those, I feel like that's a pretentious gesture that some movie critics make, and that at the same time, people that say, boy, that's a complete and utter waste of time, I feel like they were expecting a conventional movie experience.
Sure.
So I can understand.
I can understand
both extremes and I feel like I'm sort of following in the middle. It's like,
I am too.
I appreciate it in much the same way I would, you know, an abstract piece of art film I might see at MoMA or something like that. I mean, that's the experience you're going to have. There's some really nice moments that Dern has that are conventionally moving, but really, if you're going to put yourself through this, you know, consider it $10 you're paying to a museum to spend 3 hours with an artist as opposed to a film.
Entertainment, sure. It's definitely not that. So, David Lynch, we did see him at the Music Box, and maybe we should just spend a moment quick, Sam, talking about that experience. I mean, we've talked about it a little bit already, but there were some moments after the film. We spent about 20 minutes answering questions, and there was nothing super enlightening that came out of that. It was interesting, but it is true that some of the questions were just like, Mr. Lynch, you've done it again. You're a genius.
literally, that is verbatim.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I'm a sound designer, and your sound design is so brilliant.
And so is mine.
Like,
right?
It's like, come on. But all in all, you know, it was a Lynchian night, you have to say. When you start off the evening, he comes out, he introduces an organ soloist who improvs for about 2 minutes. Then he starts reading a poem that means nothing to anyone.
Although
and
the
then
poem,
he just
I have
transfers
to say,
right into
it made as much sense as the film did and actually helped me a little bit in terms of getting into the film. Because he said it was something about, like, you know, we spin our lives like a spider and then we crawl over them or something like that. I mean, the movie follows a similar logic in that it's just like, it's all laid out and you're sort of, as the viewer and maybe as the characters, you're sort of moving from room to room of the inner chamber of your mind. I don't know. Well, like I said, it's Lynchian. It was absolutely Lynchian. All right, well, if you've seen Inland Empire and agree or disagree with our takes, and really, how could you disagree?
Yeah, how could you
or
argue?
Agree? Yeah. Or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call and leave a message at 206-203-2463.
When we come back, director Tom Tykwer explains how he succeeded in making a film that the great Stanley Kubrick allegedly deemed unfilmable. Stay with us. What?
Master, can I come to work for you? My nose knows all the smells in the world.
No man can call himself a perfumer unless he has proved his worth.
The soul of beings is their scent.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam. That was a clip from the trailer for Tom Tickford's latest film, Perfume, The Story of a Murderer, a movie that was released just after Christmas here in the States, Sam, and slipped through the cracks amidst all the end-of-the-year hoopla. We're both fans of Tickford's previous films, Run, Lola, Run, Princess and the Warrior. I know you really appreciate Heaven more than I do, but that's because you're obsessed with Cate Blanchett.
That's right. And Giovanni Ribisi.
Yeah, that's true. Here, Tickford was faced with a real challenge. We've talked about this a little bit in trying to convey the power of smell on screen. The main character you heard a little bit in the clip is a young man who is so driven by his extraordinary, almost superhuman sense of smell that he becomes a murderer in this attempt to preserve the scent of various women that he becomes infatuated with. Did Tickford pull that off, Sam?
I think he did, more or less. I really think he did. And particularly, I think, by establishing this link between smell and sight pretty well for us, so we can follow along Jean-Baptiste Grenouille on this emotional journey, and that really the olfactory sense is really the only one that works with him. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated the whole fairy tale structure. I even ended up making peace with the narration, which was just this really painfully redundant narration at times. Sure. It is voiced by the great John Hurt. That made it a little easier to swallow. But I think he kept a nice light touch. It was a comic touch almost with the fairy tale elements.
Sure.
And he never undermined the really almost melodramatic core of the film, like emotional core of the character. And visually, it's totally brilliant. Like I said, I mean, establishing that link between, you know, the olfactory and the and our sight, you know, in terms of what we see and what he smells. Brilliant stuff. The women that he becomes infatuated with, at first I almost found it a little offensive because it was just like, oh, the good-looking women also smell good. How perfect for us. But it sort of has to work that way for us to appreciate what this character is going through. I found it slightly pretentious, which I took as the novel in some way. Some of the passages, particularly the narration, in terms of trying to catalog, you know, what the experience of Jean-Baptiste is going through when he can smell or when he can't smell. I feel like it was kind of overwritten in a way. But I really enjoyed it. I feel like it deserves to be seen, certainly more than it has been.
Yeah, I'm with you. I liked it too. I think we agree it's not a great film. For me, the last 30 minutes or so of this fairy tale kind of breakdown, even within the rules of a fairy tale or lack of rules. But overall, I did like it. And I remember hearing A.O. Scott from the New York Times complaining about how obvious it is. We get this close-up of Grenouille's nose, and then we cut to close-up of flowers or fish or whatever he's smelling. But I don't know how else you do it.
Right.
You know, I think that Tickford jams the frame with so much detail, and through the camera work and through the editing, you talked about this, he puts your nose right into not only the beauty, but the degradation of 18th century Paris. And there's nothing subtle about it, which I think might turn some people off. But I really thought it was effective in putting us in Grenouille's shoes. So I like the film, and I do agree with you, it's worth seeing. And I was very happy to have a chance recently to sit down with the director, Tom Tickford, here in Chicago. And I started by asking him about how he became involved with Perfume, which is based on a best-selling book by Patrick Susskind.
I read it 20 years ago, actually, when it came out. It was then an enormous bestseller. And of course, because it was a bestseller, I was a little bit opposed to it. Because you always don't want to be part of the mainstream. And at the same time, I've sensed something about it that seemed to be quite different. And then discovered that I think what's most specific about this novel is that it's so unique and that it's unlike anything else, unlike any other book that you encounter, because its concept is based on, you know, the olfactory world. Its character is driven by his nose, and it's set into 18th century France, but not the France that we know from all these period pieces where you're living with the aristocratic people and staying at garden villas having tea, but you're thrown onto the streets, into the filth of Paris, of the reality of lower class life. And on top of it, it had not only an amazing story, but also a character who is deeply disturbing, and at the same time, you're the person you have to root with.
Mm-hmm.
And everything about it was really different. So I kept that in mind as something, as an exciting read. And yes, many years later, this producer calls me and says, what about Perfume? And I had forgotten a bit about the quality. I said, let me read it again. I need to understand whether I can spend the next 4 years, as it turned out to become, of my life exclusively with this. And I discovered that I felt really connected with the guy in the center of attention, and that's something I need. I need this kind of subjective energy to be poised by. I need a subjectivity inside a film that I can identify with in order to, first of all, find a style for it, and second, of course, to be involved enough to just go for it.
Now, this is a project, everything I read about it, this movie, everyone says it was something that people considered unfilmable. And at some point, Stanley Kubrick was apparently, was that a rumor? Is that a false
it's
rumor
a total
that he was
rumor,
attached?
False rumor. He didn't say anything. I mean, of all people, Kubrick wouldn't. I mean, Kubrick's famous quote is, if it can be thought of, it can be filmed. You know, anything you can think of, you can turn into a movie. It's the director of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's... If anything is unfilmable, right, maybe then that novel. But, I mean, Perfume is like the most perfect, brilliant film concept you can just come up with. It's got everything. It's got a great plot. It's got an amazing character at the center, and it has an incredible resolution.
Well, it seems, too, a film really perfect for you. I mean, if you think about the films you've made, and even The Princess and the Warrior is a film where I think about the senses a lot in that film. There's a lot about what the characters taste and smell and hear. That's this true. Seems like the perfect kind of project for you.
Yeah, it was sheer luck, and for me, really, really, a great. I was extremely pleased to be confronted with this because, even though there were some seemingly different things about it, like it being a period piece, there was so much about it that I felt very familiar with. And, the whole experimental attitude of the material was something that, of course, very much appeals to me. And also, I always felt, I should stop complaining about all the period films that I find a bit boring or dragging or too artificial or too much showing off their design or blah, 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 and better go and make one that I like. And here was the perfect material for it because, it shows you the 18th century in a way that you probably have never experienced.
Has the author seen the movie?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Unfortunately not, because he's a very reclusive, isolated guy. He's never public. He's even hard to reach for me, so I only met him once, actually. And that meeting was very nice, very polite. He wished me all the best and good luck, and please leave me alone.
There's a fable aspect to the film. A lot of supernatural things kind of occur, there's a narrator that gives it a fable-like quality. Is that fantastic element something that drew you to it as well?
Yes. I think that's something I always need to find in material that to get me excited about it, that it's, in a way rooted in reality and in a world that I can totally position myself in and feel that it's sort of believable, and that I can follow the rules that are set up in a way that I agree with them, and then at the same time I love that films can take us into a fairy tale-y approach to reality, and that they can very much reflect the in-between world of dream and reality, and what we experience when we wake up from a dream and this little zone that we then are in between. I think that's got a lot to do with cinema and the experience of cinema. You just wake up from a dream and the dream is still alive, and you're half in reality and half in something invented.
There's an epic quality to this film, certainly the scale, the ambition of it. And even a film like Heaven, which is much smaller, more intimate kind of drama about two people, has an epic feel to it just in the way it's shot. Mm-hmm. Is that something you search for? Is that something that draws you? Is that film for you a medium that kind of requires an epic kind of take on it?
I think that's completely subjective, but I love it when films offer both, when they're intimate and controversial and complicated on one level, but that they're also epic in an exciting way, that they feel like here's not only a big subject, but also a grand attitude in approaching it, and a storytelling way that is involving and exciting and has a certain scale and gravitas. I enjoy films that can do both.
Well, one thing you don't see with films that are 18th century stories like this usually is the kind of camera work you see here in terms of the documentary style a little bit. There is a handheld nature to it. And I'm wondering, you know, is that for you the way that you kind of were able to modernize and find a way into that material?
Yeah, we felt like we should shoot it in a way as if we were taken into a time machine, could steal away with a camera, and were allowed to run around in 18th century as if it was just all there. You know, that not that anybody feels like we're presenting our decorations or the costumes, but just everybody is like that, you know, as if we were walking around on a normal street with the most modern and contemporary approach towards the character, only that it's coincidentally it's 18th century, not 21st century.
I want to ask you a little bit about the cast. You've got a lead performance here, and you've talked about here in this interview about how complicated that main hero is, Grunwei is, and you found a newcomer, this actor, Ben Whishaw, who is fantastic in this film. He's got a tough job because he's got to emote a lot and doesn't say a whole lot. That's part of who he is. Talk about the casting of him and the performance he gives.
Well, it was obvious that we wouldn't be able to make the movie work if we did not find the exact right guy to play Grunwei. And I was also quite determined not to let go of this plan and not to even start prepping the film before we had found him. But of course, it took really longer and longer and longer. And you meet all these actors, and you know, I met some really amazing actors, but at the same time, it never clicked in the way that I felt like we found the exact combination of, let's say, not only physical but also psychological and atmospheric ingredients. And then I was sent by the casting agent, I was sent to see a play in London, which was a production of Hamlet. Mm-hmm. At the Old Vic Theater, and this guy called Ben Whishaw was 23 years old and was doing Hamlet, and he was really amazing and truly different and very modern in his approach to the language. And so we auditioned him and he brought it all across, this whole thing that I had been looking for so long, the whole mix of being both vulnerable and dangerous, mm-hmm. or being innocent and dark, you know, having all these sides at the same time active, and to have somebody at the center of attention who's both scary and weirdly attractive, and where we can, you know, somebody we root with even though he's a murderer.
Well, you have this guy who is a newcomer. we as an audience get to come at it with a clean slate, and then you have a guy in contrast to that, Dustin Hoffman, who American audiences are certainly going to recognize. Even though he's covered up with makeup, we do recognize him right away. And I'm curious, you're in this fable world where I don't recognize these actors and you're really caught up in it. And then all of a sudden Dustin Hoffman shows up, and just for a second you are kind of grabbed out of the story world and you go, that's Dustin Hoffman. I didn't expect to see him here. Did you think about that at all in terms of, you know, how did you approach getting Dustin Hoffman in this film?
I never thought about it. I just, again, thought he is the perfect choice. And, you know, I think even you have maybe these 2-3 seconds when you feel like, oh my God, it's Dustin Hoffman. Then again, I think his performance is so hysterical and wonderful and heartwarming and funny and crazy, mm-hmm. and moving, that I think you very quickly forget about it. He's just the perfect choice.
Grunwei has this moment that when he goes into the city for the first time, where he ends up having the moment that defines his whole life's work, basically. I'm curious, did you have a moment like that as a filmmaker in your youth, where whether it was a poem or a book or a film that kind of you can look back on now as sort of for you the thing that kind of spurred you forward?
Well, of course, it's a continuous flow of movies that has been like the inspirational well of everything. And it probably started with, which is not very unusual because lots of filmmakers, I think, point to that film. But for me, it was also King Kong, the old King Kong. Mm-hmm. And I was something like 10 and saw it, and that was it.
That was director Tom Tykwer, whose latest film, Perfume, The Story of a Murderer, is still playing in select cities around the country.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, Massacre Theater and our animation marathon triumphantly returns with Hayao Miyazaki's Spirited Away. Stay with us.
I turned away from you. That's the way I've learned to fight. There's a moment, at any moment, it doesn't matter what's right. I won, you won. How long is long enough? I won. as an hour. There's a party tonight. I won, you won. How long is long enough? I won, you won. And if we ever find another, I won, you won. All that you hope for is anywhere in this room. A remote control that works from anywhere. Damn fine woman, Flores. I don't know how she puts up with this speech impediment of mine.
You don't have a speech impediment, Dr. Lester.
Flattery will get you everywhere, my boy. I'm afraid I have to trust Flores on that one. You see, she's got her doctorate in speech impedimentology from Case Western. I apologize if you can't understand a word I'm saying.
No, I understand perfectly.
It's very kind of you to lie. You see, I've been very lonely in my isolated tower of indecipherable speech.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. Last week, Adam and I massacred Being John Malkovich, a belabored
somewhat
tie-in with last week's special Sundance show. John Cusack, the star of Being John Malkovich, of course, starred in one of our favorite films from the festival, Grace Is Gone, which I think you'll be able to see later this year, maybe
yeah,
in the
October,
fall,
November.
Come Oscar buzz time 07.
Mm-hmm.
Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is T.J. Wells from Plainfield, Illinois. Congratulations, TJ. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
Betty.
Yeah, Betty. Look, you don't rush it. I don't rush it.
Okay?
Now, we're going to play this nice and close, just like in the movies, okay?
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater. First, we really need to congratulate TJ, though,
Wells.
On that.
That's a familiar name.
He has entered at least 100 Massacre Theaters.
I swear to God, if he has missed one,
yeah,
I'd be surprised.
Well, we're glad to see it finally pay
nice
off
work.
All your
nice
hard work.
Work
there, TJ. This week's edition of Massacre Theater, it's tying in with our top five we're going to get to in the next segment.
Right.
Top five most deserving Oscars, the moments where Oscar actually got it right,
right.
Deserving Oscars, and this actually could tie in or maybe not. I think it's a case where we'll just say it could spark a nice debate among our listeners whether or not
absolutely.
The film we're massacring really truly deserved to win the award it got. So
I think you and
with
I both
that in
agree
mind,
it does.
I think we both agree. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So with that in mind, keep the controversy in mind.
Okay.
We will get started and I start.
That's
so
right. I'm
going to
give you
the action.
And action.
Max, my server is going to send you to the showers.
Right, right. So get back to what we were discussing. The failure of the country to get behind New York City is anti-Semitism.
Max, the city is terribly run.
But I'm not discussing politics or economics. This is foreskin.
No, no, no. Max, that's a very convenient out. Every time some group disagrees with you, it's because of anti-Semitism.
Don't you see? The rest of the country looks upon New York like we're left-wing, communist, Jewish, homosexual pornographers. I think of us that way sometimes, and I live here.
Max, if we lived in California, we could play outdoors every day in the sun.
Sun is bad for you. Everything our parents said was good for you is bad. Sun, milk, red meat, college.
And scene.
Oh, God.
Nicely done,
oh,
Sam.
Oh, boy.
Okay, yeah,
that should be the
most entered massacre theater ever. If you know what film we just massacred, and frankly, if you don't, shame on you.
Stop listening to the
send
show.
Send us an email by Monday, February 12th. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
If you've actually listened through that entire Massacre Theater,
no
you
kidding.
May have thrown your iPod under the commuter train.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on our next show.
I don't care if Yubaba gets angry with us.
We're not taking humans.
She's already under contract.
What?
I promised to work very hard.
We are not going to take her in our department.
She'll stink up the whole place.
We don't want
3 days of eating our food and her smell will go away. And if she doesn't work hard, roast her, boil her, do whatever you want. Now get back to work. Where is Lynn?
What? Don't you dump her on me.
You said you wanted an assistant.
That's perfect. Give the girl to Lynn.
Oh, great.
Sen, get going.
Right.
That's a scene from the fifth film in our six-part animation marathon, Spirited Away, the story of a young girl, Chihiro, on her way to a new town, a new home, school. She takes a detour with her parents into a spirit world, has to figure out a way out of this world while also saving her parents who have been turned into...
Pigs.
Pigs, yes. That's right. Written and directed by the legendary Japanese animator. Yeah, it is.
Yikes.
A test here, Sam Pop quiz. Hayao Miyazaki. It was released in 2001 in Japan, and it's the highest-grossing Japanese film ever. Won the Oscar for Best Animated Feature, and is also the first
Talk about Oscar getting it right, actually.
Yeah,
I remember
go.
That was
yep.
such a relief. I don't remember what was
up against it, but... It was nice to see.
Yeah.
The first anime film to win an Oscar, and Sam, this is the one film in the marathon you had seen previously. What was your reaction to it now in the context of the other animated films we've discussed on the show?
Well, I certainly liked it as much as I did the first time, and I have to say that I like it. Well, no, I guess Grave of the Fireflies still stands out to me. I mean, that was 4 months ago, I realize, or seems like it is. That stands out to me as a greater achievement, maybe, in terms of the effect it had on me,
mm-hmm.
more profound. But this is an incredible film in many ways, certainly visually. I don't even think you have to have any experience watching animation. Certainly you wouldn't have had to go through a marathon of watching some landmarks in Japanese animation to appreciate it. And I think part of it is, I mean, certainly it's just beautifully imagined and realized, like this entire world. But I think it's to compare it to something like Disney or more familiar Western animation, the organic quality mm-hmm. of it, the sort of the weight of things is somehow familiar. And I don't think I realized it. It's difficult to articulate, but after the film, I went to dinner with my wife. It was dark, and we were driving in the car. And up ahead of me, a car pulled out of a street. And the way it crept out of the dark with its headlights, I was like, that's a Miyazaki creature. You know, and it was just kind of incredible, you know, transfer. I realized I was still living in Miyazaki's world mm-hmm. once I finished watching the film, and I think that's rare enough. But like I said, I did like it certainly as much as I liked it the first time around. But I think I'm better able to articulate maybe the things that didn't work for me really well. And I think part of it is the whole nature of this world. It's entirely made up, and there's a sense of rules being made up on the spot as
yeah.
the story's going on.
Sure.
And I feel like maybe Miyazaki could have done a better job establishing the rules of the place and the characters. You know, because as we go on, I feel like characters are introduced that, you know, we couldn't have seen coming or don't really have a sense of the stakes all of a sudden change late in the film with the character.
Mm-hmm.
And it has, I mean, maybe it's just because we're talking about Inland Empire too. The whole thing really had played by the rules of a dream in some way. Really, you know, Chihiro's dream world, the way she behaves,
mm-hmm.
The confidence with which she behaves.
Sure.
I mean, is there's a kind of lack of stakes there because it's just like, here, somebody gave me this thing. Maybe I'm supposed to eat it, but no, I'll just end up feeding it to everybody and getting myself out of trouble.
Uh-huh.
And the way she's kind of saved by people, there's a convenience with
sure.
which things get solved. That it's not like it diminishes from the power, but
mm-hmm.
I have seen, I think, better Miyazaki films like Porco Rosso, which again, like a film which establishes the rules of the place and plays by them all the way. And I just feel like when you're in a fantastic realm, mm-hmm. a dream world, the rules can occasionally, I feel like there's a looseness
mm-hmm.
with which the world is created that can be kind of frustrating.
Huh. Okay, well, I had a different reaction. I mean, I think ultimately I liked the film just as much as you did, maybe a little bit more. It's still behind Grave of the Fireflies in terms of how I'm ranking these films in our marathon. But for me, exactly what you're talking about is a note I made about something I liked. I love the unpredictable way the story unfolds, and that unpredictability is exactly what makes it, I think, exciting. And, you know, there isn't this linear path to her end goal. New challenges are constantly springing up that eventually do lead her to what she wants. But if you think about, you know, Western, you know, Pixar movies that we're used to or whatever, character gets in a jam, certain escapades are going to happen, but, you know, it's going to eventually just lead to the character getting out of that jam,
mm-hmm.
and we kind of know how it's going to happen. Here, from moment to moment, I think the stakes are always changing. You never know exactly if she's gotten herself in deeper and deeper and how she's ever going to dig herself out of it, and I really like that. And I like that you mentioned, too, her confidence. That's something I noted, but I love how Chihiro here, I think, behaves exactly like a 10-year-old girl. She's tough and stubborn in certain moments, and she reacts in ways that only someone who's really innocent and naive could react and maybe has that confident reaction. But then there are a couple of moments where she really breaks down and cries and wants her mommy, you know, like you would expect a girl in that situation too. I mean, I remember that first night there, I had this moment where I was just thinking to myself as a viewer, I was watching it going, wow, okay, if I was this character, I'd be freaking out right now. That's what I was thinking to myself. And then we literally cut to her sleeping there at night,
crying,
not being able to sleep.
I love
and
that.
She, yeah,
I
and,
totally
and
agree.
She's totally freaking out. I mean, that's
yeah.
Exactly,
she finally slows down. Yeah. She Lynn sort of comes in and protects her, mm-hmm. and she just breaks down.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
Was totally great for me. And you know, this is a film too that, like a lot of the animation films, the anime films we've seen, they deal with these large themes, and this film certainly does as well. But I love the subtlety with which Miyazaki handles it. This is a film about modernization, which Grave of the Fireflies is as well. You know, the abandoned park that they end up entering this spirit world. The whole idea of pollution, obviously, with the bicycle and the river spirit. And you know, it's about greed and just being detached. You have these parents who seem focused on everything, really, but their daughter in some ways. And we see how they just devour the food, even though it doesn't belong to them. And that great line he says, which is, I think, unfortunately, the sentiment too many of us would have, which is, I've got credit cards.
Yeah.
That's his response. He's like, I don't know whose food this is, but come on, it's got to be for sale, and I'll be able to get myself out of this situation with my credit card. And just this idea of apathy in general, I think that her character, Chihiro, is really disengaged from the world, and you know, but she's this positive character, and that she has this innocence that her parents don't have or have lost somewhere along the way. So all those things are there, and yet with that said, I don't think that at any point does Miyazaki ever let any of that overpower the story. It's this adventure. It's about this girl trying to get out of this predicament she and her parents have gotten themselves into.
Right, and it's not about, like, a bad girl being reformed.
No.
And I would even say the same thing about the parents. They're not bad people. Maybe they represent a lazy instinct or an instinct, but it's not villainizing, capitalism or something like that, or that instinct. And the girl, like you said, isn't necessarily need to be reformed. And I did like you said, the subtlety with which he handles a lot of the themes here, but also the ambiguity of the characters. It's not like, and it's not just the parents that aren't necessarily bad and they need to be punished or reformed, and the girl isn't bad and needs to be reformed, but all the characters. You don't even know Haku, the sort of, you know, the guy that sort of helps her along in this world. At one point, a character says, like, oh, don't trust him. Don't trust, and you're never sure throughout the rest of the film if you should be trusting her.
Shocking because you've seen him be totally trustworthy.
Right, and I thought it's a wonderful detail that's so unusual too, and none of the characters are necessarily all bad. The sort of villainous queen spirit. I mean, she has a number of moments where she's raging and brutal and nasty, but she's also really generous
then
and rewards
her, and she's granny.
Chihiro, and she's granny. Yeah, I mean, so I just, I think for all those reasons that, you know, there's a tiredness with which the formula is handled in Western animation, even as well executed as it can be.
Yeah, and speaking of that, I think if we had more time, we could get into something I'm sure some of our listeners who really love anime and love this film would like to get into, and that's this whole idea of this version that we saw, the Disney version, the John Lasseter version, and there were changes to it based on what I've read, and it's funny because some of the changes are things that, watching the film, a character would say something, would verbalize something that didn't need to be verbalized, like, oh, that's a bathhouse, and then I read later that was added in the English version to help us naive, you know, stupid Americans who wouldn't get that's a bathhouse, you know. So, and there are some changes like that. There's a change at the end, a closing bit of dialogue that I'm not sure was needed, that doesn't ruin the film for me, but I don't know that it was needed, that isn't apparently in the Miyazaki version. So anyway, maybe we can get into that on a later show, but Spirited Away definitely lived up to the hype. It was the film
deserving of
its. We put three Miyazaki films up there in a poll question. Our listeners said you had to watch it. I'm so glad we did.
Yeah, and I hope we get a chance to get to Princess Mononoke, Porco Rosso, and others. Yeah. Well, we'll finish up the animation next week with Brad Bird's The Iron Giant, a film you and I, Adam, have always wanted to get to.
Yep. So looking forward to that. We're going to take one more quick break. When we return, Sam and I give the Academy some love and reveal the top five moments when they actually gave the Oscar to the right person. Back in a moment.
There's a surplus, there's a way, the whole North Shore to give away. There's a future, there's a past, there's a moment here that never lasts. They were dreaming, they were working, they were shouting, they were faking, they were hoping. They were waiting to see how we do this time. Heaven had a hell of a day last week. Enemies becoming the friends we keep. Waking up to find we've been losing sleep.
Time now to take a look at what's new on DVD, brought to you by PureFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. Discover, trade, connect at PureFlix.com.
Out this week, Flags of Our Fathers from director Clint Eastwood, Hollywoodland with Ben Affleck, All Quiet on the Western Front, the original version from 1930, and The Science of Sleep.
My number one film of the year. Go see it.
Includes commentary from writer-director Michel Gondry and actors Gael Garcia Bernal, Charlotte Gainsbourg, and Sacha Bordeaux also chip in there on the commentary. So if you want to see what all the fuss is about,
go see it.
Check out The Science of
I'm
Sleep.
I'm making the fuss.
Out now on DVD. And also, Sam, let's go ahead and thank all of our listeners this week who were so generous to go to filmspotting.net and throw a few bucks our way via the PayPal links. Who would we like to thank this
week?
Well,
these people really wanted us to see Ghost Rider, I think. They're just
maybe
like,
so.
Please, if we give you $20, will you go see Ghost Rider? And it's like, well, probably not still. But we want to thank Riley, File Under Blessings, Sleep Deprivation, Tom, Aversion to Therapy, David, Location Anxiety, Eric, A Carrot and Two Sticks of Dynamite, and Ken, The City That Never Snows, thanks to everyone that donated this week.
The hard rain. Are coming. There's a hurricane right offshore.
Hey guys, Brendan O'Brien here from Bendigo, Victoria, Australia. Down under, hey, we've been a movie lover for years, particularly alternative or foreign movies. And the reason I'm ringing up is because I saw Short Bus a couple of weeks ago after you guys mentioned it in your Top Picks of 2006 show. And it was magnificent. The subject matter, the colour, the relaxed feeling of the movie, and its overall artistic nature made it a movie that I'm raving about to anyone who will listen to me. And what a beautiful movie.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that was a very nice voicemail from Brendan.
Love to hear that.
In Australia. We love to hear people enjoying the film.
That we love to.
Short Bus. It was actually
my number
top
two.
Five of the year, your number two film of the year. It didn't make my top 10, but a film I loved as well. Glad to know that it's getting out there around the world for people to see. We wanted to briefly mention some poll questions. The poll question that has been on our site recently that you voted in, many of you did, we asked, which is the most egregious Oscar snub? So for this year, which is the most egregious Oscar snub? And the choices were?
And the choices were Dreamgirls for Best Picture, United 93 for Best Picture, Volver for Foreign Language Film, Maggie Gyllenhaal for Best Actress in Cherry Baby, and none of the above. 34% of you said United 93. That's pretty common. I know that's what you'd say. Mm-hmm. 27% said Volver. That's a nice showing for Volver. And actually, now having seen it since the last time we recorded, that's where my vote would be. 21% said none of the above. 14% Maggie Gyllenhaal. And only 4%, I'm happy to report, said the Dreamgirls snub was the most egregious for this year's Oscars.
And we did get a number of emails from people, maybe we should acknowledge this now, who said, how can you talk about the Oscars and the biggest surprises and disappointments and not mention Dreamgirls? It was the big headline industry-wise, certainly, that Dreamgirls got snubbed and had the most nominations but didn't get Best Picture. But for us, it just wasn't really a surprise. No. I didn't expect
if
it to
anything,
get a Best Picture
nomination. If anything, it was
nomination.
Nice to see.
And it wasn't a disappointment either. So
people don't have to be talking about Dreamgirls for another 2 weeks.
Exactly. So we did kind of leave it out for that reason. This week's poll question, Sam, we are in a new year after the holidays.
Yes,
we
are.
The end of the year top 10 stuff. We are in the doldrums right now. So we thought it'd be fun to ask, which February release looks worse?
What looks worse? Ghost Rider with Nicolas Cage, Hannibal Rising, the completely unnecessary prequel to The Silence of the Lambs.
Manhunter. Actually,
and Manhunter,
yeah,
true.
Red
okay,
Dragon.
Right. Music and Lyrics with Hugh Grant and Drew Barrymore, and Eddie Murphy, Oscar nominee, Eddie Murphy going for a paycheck with Norbit.
Yeah.
What's
you know,
your choice?
It's tough because
yes, it is.
They all look bad, though I will actually go and see Music and Lyrics just
for
Hugh
Grant.
Grant's
I like Hugh
charm.
Grant. Yep.
But I don't know, Sam. I got to be honest.
Looking at this list.
Ghost Rider, Norbit, Hannibal Rising, the one I think I'm least excited to see, and I don't want to see any of them, is actually Hannibal Rising. That's the
That's
film
surprising.
I would most dread to sit through.
For me, it's definitely Norbit. And again, it's not an easy choice, but I just don't need to see that.
No.
How many times has that film been made
I know.
With any number of actors in the past 10 years? I feel like it's not even a sequel, but it feels like it's just like, well, I want the experience of Eddie Murphy dressing up. I mean, come on.
Playing 20 different characters.
Why not just make The Nutty Professor 3?
Why
Go
not?
Ahead and do it.
Yeah.
They've already got the costumes back there.
Right. So, okay, well, you heard our votes.
Yeah.
Make your voice heard. Go to filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, you can sign up for The Dope Sheet, our weekly email blast, and we are now going to give you an incentive to sign up for The Dope Sheet. we are going to award a couple prizes to random dope sheet winners. And we have to thank our great message board moderator and devoted listener, Alex Nesnick, in Dallas. He is going to give, we've actually received it, or it's on its way, an iPod Shuffle, a free iPod Shuffle,
yes,
engraved by Film Spotting from Adam and Sam, to one random Dope Sheet subscriber. So all you have to do is subscribe to the Dope Sheet, which you can do at filmspotting.net. We'll pick one random winner. You will get the iPod Shuffle engraved by, right, Film Spotting.
And shuffles are very small, so if you they don't are. Want to be showing off the From Adam and Sam and have to explain that, mm-hmm, very easy to tuck into your jacket.
That's true.
Pants,
that's true,
pocket, which is whatever it is.
Why we went with the shuffle, I'm sure. the second place person, though, Sam,
yeah,
we have to thank Paul Symptoms of Majesty.
Symptoms of Majesty,
one of our
Platinum Club,
Platinum
member,
Club
donors,
donors,
yeah,
from the UK. He sent us a copy of Idiocracy,
oh,
with Luke Wilson, the Mike Judge film that
I'm
we
desperate
both liked.
To take that home.
I know you are. And we have it in our possession. He wants some American listener, or not,
yep,
to find a home. He wants us to find a home for it with someone who deserves it. So a second place person,
yes,
another random Dope Sheet subscriber,
Dope Sheet,
will,
right,
get Idiocracy sent out to them. So again, all you have to do, and if you've already signed up for the Dope Sheet, great, you're in the running.
Oh, yes, you're in the
We're
running.
We're
going
to be,
right,
picking from all of the subscribers. Sign up now at filmspotting.net. Okay, it is top five time, Sam. With the Oscars coming up, we're, of course, in our Oscar mode. We're going to, yeah, on
we're
our next
milk
show,
this. We're
we are
milking
milk
the
it.
Oscars.
We're going to pick our Oscar winners, who should win, who will win. But right now, we wanted to take a look back at the times when Oscar got it right. Because,
yeah, last
more
year,
often
I
than
think,
not, they don't.
Yeah, and last year,
blunders.
I think we were like biggest blunders.
Yeah,
yeah,
last
let's show
February,
some love.
It was,
yeah,
top five Oscar blunders. There were, right, so many to choose from, the times they got it wrong.
Right.
You thought, hey, why not? Let's give them some credit, yeah, when they got it right. So why don't you jump right in with your number five?
Yeah, I want to say, too, that I didn't even look anywhere further back than 1970. And most of my picks are even more recent than that, only because it's like I wanted to have a sense of who the other nominees were. And so I could legitimately say this is the most deserving candidate.
Fair enough.
That being said, number five, 1999, actress in a leading role. The nominees are Annette Bening in American Beauty, Janet McTeer, Tumbleweeds, Julianne Moore, The End of the Affair, Meryl Streep, Music of the Heart, and then winner, Hilary Swank, Boys Don't Cry. I think I like this pick most of all. Not only is it, I think, the best performance of the year, male or female, honestly, but Annette Bening was shut out. Not specifically anything against Annette Bening, but American Beauty was shut out. It already won director, screenplay, best picture. Enough already. Thank you, Hilary Swank, for giving the performance of 1999.
Okay, actually, I agree with you. It was not in my top five, but definitely on my short list. And I'm going to back-to-back actress choices. The nominees in 1995 for Best Actress, Elizabeth Shue, Leaving Las Vegas, Sharon Stone for Casino, Meryl Streep for Bridges of Madison County, and Emma Thompson for Sense and Sensibility, but they gave it to Susan Sarandon in Dead Man Walking. I think she was deserving. And the following year, 1996, easily could have gone, and I'm still torn on this, it easily could have gone to Emily Watson for Breaking the Waves, but they gave it to Frances McDormand in Fargo. I love that performance. She makes Marge Gunderson a quirky, funny, but extremely real character. Those two choices, back-to-back Best Actress choices, the Academy got it right.
All right, 2002, actor in a supporting role. Nominees are Ed Harris in The Hours, Paul Newman, Road to Perdition, John C. Reilly in Chicago, Christopher Walken in Catch Me If You Can, but they gave it to the great Chris Cooper in Adaptation. Ed Harris, Paul Newman, Walken, elder statesman,
yeah,
you know, nostalgia vote for Paul Newman. You really felt like it was going that way. Road to Perdition kind of ran out of steam, and mm-hmm, maybe that's why it didn't go that way. Walken giving a more serious role than the quirky kind of stuff he'd been doing recently. But really, Chris Cooper gave the most outstanding performance in this. Maybe it's because he was wearing the bad teeth.
Maybe.
I don't know. He still deserved it. Great, great performance.
I agree. Another one on my short list as well. Very happy to see Chris Cooper get the win. An actor I'd always liked. Nice to see him get that validation. And I'm going, it's funny that you have this pattern so far. We have this pattern, Sam, because my number four, I've got two best supporting actor choices. 1988, Martin Landau Tucker, River Phoenix for Running on Empty, Dean Stockwell for Married to the Mob, and Alec Guinness in a film I have not seen, Little Dorrit, and they gave it rightly to Kevin Kline for A Fish Called Wanda. Back in our 100th episode, I said it was my all-time number one favorite male comedic performance. There it is. He got the Oscar. And also Benicio Del Toro for Traffic in 2000. He beat Jeff Bridges in The Contender, Willem Dafoe in Shadow of the Vampire, Albert Finney in Aaron Brockovich, and Joaquin Phoenix in Gladiator. And I like all those performances, though I think Joaquin Phoenix was a little too campy for my taste.
But I felt like maybe that's the direction they were going to go. I totally,
yeah,
agree.
No,
it was
I
on my short
so too,
list, too. Del
but
Toro
Benicio
was,
Del Toro, yeah, he's the moral center of that film, and yet you don't really know until the end what kind of person this guy really is, because Del Toro never indicates to you how good or bad he is. This Mexican cop having a crisis of conscience, he's brilliant.
He is totally brilliant. It's not a showy role either, mm-hmm. which I think even more deserving. Great pick. 1989, actor in a leading role. 89. I mean, as a 14-year-old in 89, this was the zenith of Billy Crystal's hosting duties. You know, very memorable. You had Driving Miss Daisy versus Born on the 4th of July in the Best Actor going head-to-head. Tom Cruise, youngest Best Actor nominee. Jessica Tandy, the eldest. I remember these being the sort of themes going into the 89. Telecast. Nominees for actor, you had Kenneth Branagh and Henry V in addition to Tom Cruise in Born on the 4th of July, Morgan Freeman, Driving Miss Daisy, Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society. But they gave it to the actor in a film that had made, I think, under $2 million at voting time, Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot. One of the great performances of all time. Absolutely outstanding. It really would be the equivalent of giving Ryan Gosling the Oscar for his portrayal in Half Nelson.
So.
You know, a film that few people have seen, this sort of incredible breakthrough performance by Gosling. It's not going to happen this year, but it happened in 89.
Okay. Well, my number three choice here, I'm going back to the year 1991. It's a triumvirate choice, and it's funny because it's a film that I don't even love, but when you consider it up against the other nominees, and it is a film I really like, and it's Silence of the Lambs winning Best Picture, Anthony Hopkins winning Best Actor, and Jodie Foster winning Best Actress, because if you look at the nominees, Beauty and the Beast, Bugsy, JFK, The Prince of Tides, I'll take Silence of the Lambs over all four of those films, and Hopkins beat Warren Beatty for Bugsy, De Niro for Cape Fear, Nolte for The Prince of Tides, and Robin Williams for The Fisher King. Again, I like many of those performances, but Anthony Hopkins created an iconic character there. Incredibly creepy, fun role as Hannibal Lecter. And then I looked at Jodie Foster, who I remember on the surface looking at it thinking, did she really deserve the Oscar that year? But when you look at who she was against, Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon for Thelma and Louise, I liked them both. Laura Dern for Rambling Rose and Bette Midler for The Boys. I think her performance did stand out against those.
Boy, looking at some of these years, you're just like cringeworthy.
Yeah,
some of the picks
for
Best Picture. I think I'm not necessarily going to include 1984 in that, but that's where I'm headed. And 84, I was looking at all the nominees in 84. I couldn't believe how few real serious Best Picture, real serious candidates there were that year. Yes, it was the year of Ghostbusters, Splash, Footloose, and Broadway Danny Rose, but among the Best Picture nominees, you had The Killing Fields, legitimate picture, mm-hmm. has some legs, A Passage to India, Places in the Heart, and A Soldier Story.
Right.
Who has seen The Soldier
Story?
I
have seen it. I've seen
Fine.
It 100
You're
times,
You're among 10.
Actually.
Oh, really?
And I like
Is
the
it
movie.
On HBO or something like
it
that?
It was when I was a kid, all the time.
But they gave the Best Picture award to Amadeus. Easily, I think, the greatest achievement in film that year, by far. I mean, yes, Ghostbusters, but if not Ghostbusters,
right.
then Amadeus.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't know how I overlooked that, because against those choices, there's no doubt Amadeus would have gotten my Best Picture vote. So a good choice there. My number two, I'll be shocked if it's not somewhere here in your top five, Sam. If not your number one, and it's 1992 is where I'm heading for a little film Clint Eastwood made called Unforgiven. It beat Son of a Woman, a film I really do like. Howard's End, a film I also like, and The Crying Game, a film I like. A Few Good Men, I like, don't love. But against those four choices, Unforgiven is a film that I can admit that I only recently saw and think it's absolutely brilliant, especially in the context of Westerns and putting it against the Westerns we saw from the 50s and 40s and the 60s, that whole golden age of Westerns, seeing how Eastwood deconstructs those films. It's a brilliant
film.
And
David Webb Peoples, too, who wrote the screenplay. It's an outstanding film.
It is.
And it was in my shortlist. I'm surprised it didn't make it, too, but I used this kind of sub-criteria that I chose things that where they easily could have gone a different direction. And as I recall from 92, it seemed like Unforgiven's year, and maybe that's why I knocked it out of the top five, but I totally agree, totally deserving. Great pick. But my number one, a little less obvious, but it's actually in the directing category in 2000. Stephen Daldry nominated for Billy Elliot, Ang Lee for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Steven Soderbergh for Aaron Brockovich, Ridley Scott for Gladiator, which went on to win Best Picture, and then Steven Soderbergh again for Traffic.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about Benicio del Toro winning the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. Here, Soderbergh, I think, up against Lee and Scott, who made these epic films, there maybe you can see them going in that direction. Never mind the fact that Soderbergh already nominated in the category. You think maybe a split vote's going to be there, but they went with Traffic. I think the greatest achievement in directing that year, you've got this big cast, this complicated, complex story. He keeps things light, interesting, entertaining, but still very thoughtful. I think it's a great, great directing job on his part, and I'm glad that it was recognized.
Light and entertaining in Traffic?
In a sense, there are those moments where it's never completely heavy. I just think of I wouldn't describe it as light and entertaining, but I remember he kept things light. It's a serious subject matter, and there were entertaining moments. I think of Don Cheadle and Luis Guzman, the sort of interplay there. A lot of the stuff, again, not a comedy, Traffic, but still, Soderbergh's style, keeping things light, keeping things, keeping the whole film on its toes. It's a great achievement.
Okay, nice try. But it is a good choice, and it deserves to be there. And I loved many of those films, including Crouching Tiger. I remember thinking if they gave it to Ang Lee, I'd be fine with that. If they gave it to Ridley Scott, I was fine with it. But I was really happy to see that my favorite film of the year was Traffic. And Steven Soderbergh, a great choice. And we're on now to my number one. And I am going with a year again, a triumvirate of choices, 1980. They famously got Best Picture wrong, giving Ordinary People the Oscar ahead of Raging Bull, Martin Scorsese's film, of course. But for the most part, they got the acting categories right. Robert Duvall in The Great Santini. These are all great performances, but Duvall in The Great Santini, John Hurt in The Elephant Man, Jack Lemmon in Tribute, and Peter O'Toole in The Stuntman. But they gave it to Robert De Niro. Jake LaMotta, one of my favorite performances ever. And then Sissy Spacek winning for Coal Miner's Daughter. It's an interesting year because I haven't seen two of the films that got nominated. I hadn't even heard of, I will admit, the Ellen Burstyn film Resurrection.
Me neither.
I hadn't heard of it. I still haven't. Jenna Rollins in Gloria, the Cassavetes film, I have not seen. But Mary Tyler Moore gives a great performance in Ordinary People. And, of course, Goldie Hawn is funny and comedic in Private Benjamin. But with those choices, Sissy Spacek, I love her, Loretta Lynn in that film. And then also Timothy Hutton winning Best Supporting Actor for Ordinary People, even though he's the star of that film and probably should have got Best Actor, not against De Niro, though. But he beat out Judd Hirsch, also from Ordinary People, Michael O'Keefe from The Great Santini, Joe Pesci from Raging Bull, and Jason Robards from Melvin and Howard. So they got the acting choices right if they did not give the proper love to Raging Bull. And I just want to end by saying quickly, this list for me is the Meryl Streep memorial list for her win as Sophie in Sophie's Choice.
I can't believe you didn't
in 1982. It's the memorial Sophie's Choice list, which I've already done 10 times on this show probably. I also want to point people to our Pantheon list on our top five page of filmspotting.net.
Yeah, the Godfather
movies
we
exclude automatically because they're too obvious. Godfather 1 and 2, Goodfellas, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Deer Hunter. All those films could be up there for me.
Right. And so there's your love, Oscars, and it was nice to go through this list. There were probably at least 15. Like you said, a lot of your picks weren't on mine. I don't think any of them were, in fact. I agree with all of yours. You were in agreement with mine, and that's just nice to see. And let's hope a couple weeks from now, Oscar gets it right again. All right, well, opening and wide release this weekend, the Manhunter Red Dragon prequel, Hannibal Rising, and Oscar-nominated Eddie Murphy takes the latex to the multiplex with Norbit. What are we going to see?
I don't know.
Up in the air.
We have been avoiding 2007 films, and maybe next week we'll have to jump into something.
Yes.
Maybe Hannibal Rising. We're really curious about Breaking and Entering, the Anthony Minghella film, which is out in limited release. We'll have to see what we do. It's totally wide open at this point. Feel free to email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Tell us what to see.
Tell us what to review. Please send any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net, and help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. And of course, on the blog, you can also sign up for the Dope Sheet, our weekly email blast, which, as we said, two winners will get. One will get an iPod Shuffle. The other will get a copy of Mike Judge's Idiocracy.
Thanks to the Silos for today's music. Please check them out on the web at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Halbert.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by the new PeerFlix. Discover, trade, connect at PeerFlix.com. And by Farb Forever, now on DVD. Farb Forever takes an in-depth look at Brett Favre's career from his high school and college days through his NFL career, from a near-fatal car accident to an unsuccessful rookie NFL season, to an unforgettable Monday Night Football performance 24 hours after his father's death, to a glorious victory in Super Bowl 31. Farb Forever is narrated by Billy Bob Thornton and packed with highlights and rarely seen footage. It's the ultimate tribute to one of the NFL's greats, the much-anticipated Farb Forever, now on DVD and available at ProFootballDVD.com.